Hi, podcasters. Ira Flatow here with a request. You know from listening to the show that we deal in facts and realities. And one of those realities is that it takes many hundreds of thousands of dollars to make Science Friday and these free podcasts that hopefully you enjoy. The other reality is that we at Science Friday have to raise a great majority of that money ourselves. Yes, we get some from your donations to your public radio station, so please keep doing that. But that only covers a fraction of our costs. And sure, we get some money from the underwriting announcements here, but hardly enough to cover our expenses. Hundreds of thousands of you download these podcasts each week, each month. You have the power to keep us going. If every one of you gave us just a dollar, we could ensure the future of these broadcasts and these podcasts. We need your help. Please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the donate button there. Give us $1, $5, whatever you think it's worth to you to keep Science Friday part of your week. Please donate what you can at sciencefriday.com. And thanks. And now, on to the program. What do the Cross Your Heart Bra, the I Can't Believe It's a Girdle, and the Apollo 11 spacesuit have in common? Well, they're all designed by the International Latex Corporation, better known to you as Playtex. This hour, we'll talk to the author of a new book on the history and design of the spacesuit. Plus, what if your computer or your car knew when you were happy or angry and could react to your mood? We'll talk with a researcher who's using technology to measure our emotions while we're online, driving, even shopping. The research is being used to help autistic kids communicate. We'll find out more. And Lawrence Krauss is back with a new book, Quantum Man, a look at the life and science of the popular and brilliant physicist Richard Feynman. All coming up. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What if our gadgets were, well, a little more sensitive? What if they knew that we were getting frustrated or mad or even tired, and they could tailor our experience, whether it's shopping online or driving our cars? They could tailor those experiences to suit our mood, maybe make us a little happier. Or if your car knew you were knew your driving habits so well that it could sense when you were getting angry, and it could intervene, sort of like a built-in road rage-o-meter, and keep you from doing something stupid on the highway. Well, scientists at MIT are working on devices, including webcams and special wristbands, that help measure emotions in people. The data they collect might help us make better communicators or drivers. Or maybe the devices could one day help people with emotional or physical problems, like autism, communicate their feelings and needs better to us. What do you think? Would you want your computer or a wristband to track your emotions and learn about them and maybe interact better with you or maybe take care of you, or you think that's an invasion of your privacy? Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Let me introduce my guest. Rosalind Picard is Director of Effective Computing Research and Director of Autism and Communication Technology at the MIT Media Lab. She's also Professor of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT and co-founder and chief scientist at Affectiva. That company is Affectiva Incorporated. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Picard.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Can you describe exactly what emotion sensing is and how our emotions are sensed?
Well, first of all, what we're sensing is some outwardly measurable aspects of emotion, which is not quite the same as knowing what you're really feeling inside. For example, we can, using a camera, recognize your facial expressions. And if you choose to show that you're frustrated or angry or smiling and pleased, then the camera can start to interpret that information and hopefully respond respectfully like a person hopefully would. We can also put a sensor on if you choose. It's all opt-in. And from the surface of your skin, pick up some changes that are happening inside your body. And those can be indicative of some aspects of your emotions changing as well.
What kind of changes would it sense?
Well, the main one that our sensor picks up on now is the electrodermal activity. That's small changes in conductance sensed from the surface of your skin. And those are activated when your sympathetic nervous system, sometimes known as the fight or flight system in your brain, is activated. So when that fires, it affects the innervation of the nerves around the sweat glands under the skin. And even before you sweat, we can pick up those changes.
How different or similar is this to what is being sensed on polygraph tests?
This is one of the signals used in polygraph tests, but it doesn't just change with lying. For example, it can go up with things that you're positively excited about, like getting ready to meet somebody very special to you. It can go up.
Mm-hmm. And you work with the idea that we might be able to get our machines, which they all have computer chips in them right now, of course, to be able to interact with us better and understand our emotions or things that we're feeling. And you're also looking at it for possibly helping out kids with autism.
Yeah, there are a lot of people for whom our technology is actually useful right now, while the general emotional intelligence machine still kind of has a ways to go. But right now we have people who are wearing our sensors, say, who are unable to speak and unable to talk about their feelings. Mm-hmm. And people are kind of trying to guess what's going on by looking at them on the outside, and that's extremely inaccurate. And while the sensor is not a perfect readout of your emotions, it does tell you some changes that you can't always see accurately on the outside, and those can be really valuable.
Mm-hmm. When you take these measurements, how many do you, how do you calibrate the machine? What's the process that goes on here?
We actually don't have to do any lengthy calibration. You can just put the sensor on and see the level and then watch how it changes within a person. So when a person's relaxed, it goes down. When they get excited about something, it goes up. So it's pretty easy. Now, people may have different absolute levels, but it's very easy to adjust for those by just looking at them over the course of the day.
Is it easier to tell when someone's getting angry or getting happy?
Interesting. Usually we would look at the face for that. If you're getting really happy, both could be activating for our sensor, anger and happiness. And hopefully the face would tell you if it was positive or negative. However, we just presented some results at a conference I met in California showing that sometimes when people are frustrated, they respond with a happy smile. And that may be a coping mechanism. So it's important to look not just at the smile and not just at the autonomic response.
I've seen commercials recently for automobiles that will detect when you're falling asleep or avoid oncoming objects if you're a little drowsy. Mm-hmm. Is this that same kind of idea here, at least in that frame reference?
We haven't focused on driver drowsiness, but the same kinds of signals could be used for that, yes. So you could look at things like, are the eyes closing? Is the head falling forward? Is the person's muscle tone kind of fading? And is the skin response, which also shows very interesting patterns during sleep, changing in a way that looks like the person's falling asleep?
Do you find that people are eager to use this, or do they see this perhaps as an invasion of their privacy?
Well, I mean, if somebody forces this on you, I would see it, as an invasion of privacy.
Right.
But our technology is all designed to be opt-in, and you can wear it or not. You can turn your camera on or not. So I would certainly not force this on anybody. I think what we find is a lot of people are very curious about what's going on inside themselves, and they want to try it. And when they see it, they learn things, and that's really helpful to them. So, if you want to learn about yourself, then give it a try. You can keep the data private, or you can share it with others if you feel you trust them.
And if we wanted to try this, how could we do that?
Well, I'm delighted to say the sensors we've invented at MIT no longer have to be sent out with a grad student and a soldering iron attached. Affectiva's selling them. If you go to affectiva.com, you can learn more about them or mail info@affectiva.com. They are providing the sensors primarily right now for researchers, and we are planning to come out with a consumer version later in the year.
Let's go to Mary in Cincinnati. Hi, Mary. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually like to sing in my car when I'm driving, and, if it's something that I really enjoy, I might get into it. And I'm wondering if someone were to be singing, like, an angry song or an emotional song, if the software that you're talking about, interpreting our driving and changing the way our car responds, if that might have a negative, impact or reaction if we're, enjoying the music.
I certainly think we should be very wary of how we have the car respond differently to us in our affective states. Some of the things people have done that I thought were really smart were, for example, if your GPS is talking to you and you're angry, then it better not sound cheery, right? The voice might want to change its tone to be more subdued. On the other hand, if you're like really happy singing, you know, cheery, and the voice reflects that, then it's been shown people actually drive more safely when that voice responds, becoming more cheery when they're cheery or becoming more subdued when they're angry. So that I would see as something that would, you know, improve our performance behind the wheel, and that I would welcome.
That's interesting. Thanks for calling, Mary. Happy singing.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm sure it's disco music. Let me ask you a question, Dr. Picard. If your car, let's take this car example because I think it's fascinating. If your car discovers that you're angry, might it speak up like a friend would say and warn you to calm down a bit? Or, you know, you might be on the brink of road rage here, soothing, something like that?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think there's going to be an interaction with personality. If it did that and you didn't like it, it had better not keep doing that because that could make you angrier. And that would make you a less safe driver. I've been told by others that anger equals 3 beers behind the wheel of a car. If you're really angry, don't hop in the car. Do something else for a while. And whatever it takes to get you to calm down would be what we would want to learn how to do to support you if that happened in the car.
Mm-hmm. So you might actually, though, opt in to choose something like that to warn you.
Yeah. If you have a problem, like we're working with people who struggle with emotion dysregulation, whether it's anxiety attacks or panic attacks or cravings that precede substance abuse. And if we can measure that pattern unique to them and understand how to help support them at that moment, then we can, through the mobile device, actually bring them a response to their sensed data that is hopefully helpful for them.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine this would be useful in a shopping situation where...
There are a lot of companies interested in shopping. I know now that we're completely mobile and you can just wear this in regular life, you know, you go in the store and you can see, you know, what makes your signal go up. And usually it's bad stuff. Usually it's something like, you know, one of those frustrating checkout machines that's not making sense.
So it detects that you're sitting there frustrated online because the person has 15 items in the 10-item line.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it knows that and it offers you a coupon.
Yeah, actually, we've been looking at ways that, you know, people might be... Well, some people just intrinsically want to learn about their data. Other people might be, you know, a little reluctant, like, why would I turn on my camera on the web, you know, when I'm shopping? But if it's just like them looking at you in the store and they give you a coupon, you know, at checkout, why not turn on your camera and let them see that you're confused by the screen that they're showing you at the checkout section?
Yeah, or if you're, you know, you have one of those electronic carts now that have all these TV screens on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe it could detect and then offer you something on that screen or point you to a sale that's going on in the store or something like that.
I'm sorry? What do we do with sales?
Or it could point you to something on sale to make you a little happier, offer you something.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, we can easily detect smiles of delight, people walking in and out and looking at things. And certainly if you give people an unexpected surprise that's delightful, they can feel really good about that experience and want to come back and even want to tell others about it.
Well, thank you very much for telling us about it.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Take care.
Rosalind Picard is Director of Effective Computing Research and Director of Autism and Communication Technology at that famous MIT Media Lab. She is also Professor of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT and co-founder and chief scientist at Affectiva Incorporated. And she says you can actually experience this for yourself. If you want to find out more about it, you can go to their website and see what it's like to have that kind of interaction. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Lawrence Krauss. Dr. Krauss will be here to talk about his new book, which is The Life and Times of Richard Feynman. And you can call us 1-800-989-8255. The book is called Quantum Man. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll be talking about one of the most interesting physicists of the 20th century. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. If you're of a certain age, you remember physicist Richard Feynman for his work on quantum physics, or his love of the bongo drums, Or you may remember Feynman for his famous demonstration of the effects of ice-cold water on the elasticity of rubber. As a member on the Rogers Commission, that was a commission set up to study the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster, here he is talking about the O-rings that were believed to have caused the shuttle explosion.
Well, I took this stuff that I got out of your seal, and I put it in ice water. And I discovered that when you put some pressure on it for a while and then undo it, it doesn't stretch back. It stays the same dimension. In other words, for a few seconds at least, and more seconds than that, there's no resilience in this particular material when it's at a temperature of 32 degrees. I believe that has some significance for our problem.
That was a famous demonstration that Feynman did in the committee, and basically dipping material that the O-rings was made out of into ice water and showing how that they lose their resiliency. Feynman was a showman. He was a character, nine-part scientist, one-part showman, and to many lay people, he made science accessible and understandable. But to scientists, Feynman was really a physicist's physicist. My next guess is Feynman had an unparalleled talent for mathematics. And his intuition, his hard work, his ability to think about physics problems in different ways, his own way, helped to earn him a Nobel Prize. Joining me now to talk more about Richard Feynman is his most recent biographer, himself a physicist, Lawrence Krauss, author of Quantum Man, Richard Feynman's Life in Science. He's the foundation professor and director of the ASU Origins Project, and he joins us from the studios of KJZZ. Welcome back to Science Friday, Lawrence.
It's always great to be back, Ira.
Well, why do you call him a physicist's physicist?
Well, he was an idol for all of us. He was a role model. He could apparently do anything, first of all, almost any problem he seemed to be able to solve. But he also established, he was sort of the conscience of physics in a way. He could joke around, as you mentioned. He was a prankster. But he was, when it came to science, he was dead serious. And he had no tolerance for nonsense, show, or hype. And I think that all of those aspects, and the fact that what he said was, you know, in order to really, really do physics, you have to be able to calculate things, get the numbers out, and compare with experiment, which is something many of us need to remember often.
So he really believed in the mathematics of what was going on.
Well, not just the mathematics, but more importantly, the fact that the mathematics alone didn't make sense or wasn't useful unless you could compare it to experiment, unless you can get something out of it that allowed you to compare to the real world. And I think that's really important. What makes physics and science are wonderful. The ideas are incredible, and I love talking about them. But what makes science worth talking about is that it works. It allows us to understand the world, predict it, and ultimately control it at some level.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking with Lawrence Krauss, author of A Quantum Man, Richard Feynman's Life in Science. And that little bit of tape we played of his demonstration of the rubber, the kind of rubber used in the shuttle in the ice water, was that typical of the way he approached problems, like just totally out of his own way of thinking?
Well, it was typical in a number of ways, I think. First of all, he tended to ignore hype and went around NASA's claims about their ability to talk to engineers and the good communication within NASA at the time, and he went straight to the engineers. He figured, if I want to understand the problem, I'll go to the place where I can learn the most. And that's what he was interested in, was learning about the world and not worrying about what people told him about the world, but finding out for himself. So he went directly to the engineers and solved that problem. The other aspect, the showman aspect, was equally characteristic. And, you know, I think it began really early when he was just a child and 10 or 11. He had a radio repair business back in the old days when there were tubes in radios, which happily we don't have anymore. But he used to become famous because he would fix them by thinking. And there's a famous example where someone brought in a radio where it was shrieking at high decibel level and no one could stand it. And he had turned it on with the radio shrieking, and he stood there and paced back and forth for 10 minutes and looked at it and then interchanged two tubes and the shrieking stopped. And I'm convinced, even as a child, he knew right away what the problem was, but he left it going for a long time just to add to the effect.
Tell us, for people who never knew anything about him or just knew him from his later years in life, what made his reputation? What was he famous for?
Well, that's the key point. I mean, the point of the book is it's a scientific biography. There are lots of biographies of the man because he was so fascinating. but very few really focus on the science, and that's what I wanted to do. Use Feynman's life as a hook, if you wish, to talk about his science, which spanned really almost every major development in the 20th century and even the 21st century. The reason it's called Quantum Man is what he did was redevelop and redefine for us our whole view of quantum mechanics. He presented a picture of the quantum world, which was completely different than which was available at the time. And of course, you know, that alone is interesting, I suppose. It gives you a very intuitive understanding of quantum mechanics. It really was involved by talking about the paths that particles take and realizing that in the quantum world, particles can take many different paths at the same time. And you have to take all that into account to solve the problem. But more importantly, that technology that he developed was not only insightful, it allowed him to develop a new calculational scheme that allowed the merging of relativity, quantum mechanics, electromagnetism into a theory with which we could calculate. And it has now become the best theory in physics, in all of science. It's the only place where you can compare theoretical predictions with experiment from first principles to, say, 9 decimal places. And we can do that in large part because of the calculational techniques that Feynman developed, including things called Feynman diagrams. There's not an issue of physics today that doesn't have Feynman diagrams in it. And that technology, you know, when he said, there was an interesting moment when he really knew that was his Nobel Prize. He won the Nobel Prize much later. But after he developed this scheme, he was at a conference, and someone was doing a calculation that took 2.5 years. And Feynman arrived, and people were claiming it was wrong. And Feynman arrived the night before, redid the calculation in much greater generality in a single night. And when he discovered he could do in a single night what had required 3 or 4 years before, then he said, that's when I got my prize. That's when I knew I had something really useful. And that's what Feynman wanted to do. But if he'd stopped there, you know, that would have been enough, as we say. But he went on to make incredible impacts in the fields of low-temperature physics, describing from first principles and explaining superfluidity in liquid helium, the amazing fact that liquid helium below a certain temperature becomes superfluid. It'll flow out of any container no matter what you do with it. He, in fact, apropos of the interview you just did, he was involved in computers. In fact, really proposed quantum computing, which is now at the heart of a lot of what people are trying to do in developing new types of computers. He was involved in quantum gravity and ultimately in the theory of the strong interaction. So basically almost every major development in 20th and 21st century physics, Feynman was involved in, which for me was the reason I wanted to tell this story, because it's great. It's a great way through a narrative, to bring people up to date on what's happening in physics.
1-800-989-8255, talking with the Lawrence Krauss, author of Quantum Man. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Alan in Davenport, Iowa. Hi, Alan.
Yes, hello. One thing that recently I understand is not really experimental in the sense you can't get any results from it is string theory. I wonder how Mr. Feynman, what would your guess be that he would, and how would he approach string theory?
Well, I don't have to guess because he actually made some comments about it. He was not a big fan of string theory at the time, because it didn't produce any numbers that could be compared with experiment. In fact, he said it doesn't really explain anything. It has to be excused most of the time. And he found, you know, he was very naturally skeptical. And I think it's important for scientists to be skeptical. And so he you know, as he said, I've heard a lot of people saying they have more or less the theory of everything over the years, and it hasn't worked out. And I think what Feynman said is maybe it'll be true, but right now it really has to be excused most of the time. And it doesn't. If it doesn't agree with experiment, then they make an excuse. Or if it can't do a calculation, they make an excuse. Now, a lot of progress has been made. And I think he probably would still be highly skeptical of the idea. And, you know, what he said is that for him, he wasn't aiming to get a theory of everything. In some sense, as my friend Frank Wilczek said, Feynman wanted to have a theory of something. Namely, what he wanted to do was understand things. And as he said, he didn't care whether the universe was like an onion, where every time you peel back a layer, there was something new to learn, and there was an infinite amount to learn, or whether there would ultimately be some theory that you could put on a T-shirt that would explain everything. He just wanted to understand things. And at the point he was working, string theory really didn't explain anything for him, and he was therefore rather dismissive of it.
I think one of the interesting parts about his life is that you talked about all the things that he was a pioneer in, and one of those things he talked about in his career that people had not heard about at that point, or at least outside of the physics world, was nanotechnology, nanoparticles and things. And he talked about how there was room at the bottom
in a very famous paper in 1960, just a general paper, way in advance of the period when we could actually do these things, he realized, look, there's a whole new world of technology that we're not exploring. And he started to think about what you might be able to do if you could explore. And ultimately, he said, maybe we can get down at the level where quantum mechanics itself becomes manifest, and then we can make machines that depend on quantum mechanics. And wouldn't that be fascinating? And in order to promote the idea, he did something interesting. This was before he won the Nobel Prize. He actually offered prizes, two $1,000 prizes for two bits of nanotechnology that he proposed. One was a motor that would be less than 1/64 of an inch on the side, fully working. And the other was a prize for someone who could put an entire page of a book on a region of material less than 1/25,000th of an inch. And to his dismay, to some extent, someone came along within 6 months and had a motor. He wasn't prepared to give the prize. And he said, he was a little disappointed because it didn't require any new technology. But he said, now don't start writing things small because I just bought a house and I don't plan to make good on the next prize because I'm married and I got to pay for the house.
Well, 1-800. Did he have was he tolerant of, you know, there's an interesting account in your book about an exchange with us. Steven Weinberg, who would go on to win the Nobel Prize, and he hammered Steven Weinberg in a talk that Weinberg was giving. Why do you think he could be such a harsh, you know, so harsh on an audience member there?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because he was fascinating to talk to, and if he put his interest on you, it was captivating. And the minute he was interested in something, you had to say it was amazing. But he wasn't tolerant of approaches that he didn't like. It surprises me that. I think because Steve Weinberg is an amazing scientist, but approaches things very differently than Feynman did. Steve tends to look at the most general possible case and, like a bulldozer, solve that problem and then deal with specific examples, where Feynman used to sort of try and understand specific examples. And maybe that was part of the reason that he wasn't so nice to Weinberg that time. But more importantly, he was intolerant of people expressing nonsense. And there was an example which is, again, maybe significant because involved a future Nobel Prize winner, Fred Rhinus, who won the Nobel Prize for the discovering the neutrino. And there was a very famous example years later, well before Rhinus won the Nobel Prize, and perhaps it contributed to the delay in Rhinus winning the Nobel Prize, where Rhinus made a claim about neutrinos in an experiment, and Feynman looked at the experiment, realized immediately it was nonsense, and publicly, in some sense, at a meeting, humiliated him because he basically said, you know, his feeling was that he had no tolerance for nonsense, and he thought the experimentalists should check their results better. You know what Feynman also said, which I think is really important, is that we all want to believe in some sense. And he said, you know, he used to go around to people and he used to say, you won't believe what happened to me today. You just won't believe what happened. And they'd say, what? And he'd say, absolutely nothing. Because most people, when something happens to us, we think it's significant. And sometimes it's just an accident. And the same happens to experimentalists. Sometimes in their experiment, there's a weird glitch. And sometimes they can believe it's real and unfortunately go out and publish it. And Feynman basically said, look, you have to, if you're a scientist, try and prove what's right about your ideas, but you have to prove what's wrong at the same time. And he had very little tolerance of people who didn't question themselves before they went out in public.
Talking with Lawrence Krauss, author of Quantum Man on Science Friday from NPR. Let's see if we can go back to the phones, take a call or two. David in Cincinnati. Hi, David.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi there.
I was wondering about religion and science. I'm not a scientist or anything, but I'm always hearing about, well, if you're religious, you don't deal with the facts, then you can't be a scientist, and religion has nothing to do with science. Is that true in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, that religion indeed does have very little to do with science. I think Feynman also expressed a notion a number of different ways. He said once, I don't feel frightened by not knowing things, by being lost in a mysterious universe without any purpose, which is the way it really is as far as I can tell, possibly. It doesn't frighten me. So I think that the point with Feynman was that what he said is, I'd rather not understand things than be certain of something which is wrong. And I think his suspicion about certain aspects of religion is that people felt they knew the answer without discovering it. So Feynman was not religious. There are some religious scientists, and it's not impossible to be religious and be a scientist. There are many good religious scientists. But for Feynman, and to some extent for myself, I think the notion is that we'd rather that it's the mystery of the universe that's so exciting. And as far as we can tell, there's no evidence for any supernatural requirements. We can understand the history of the universe back to the earliest moments of the Big Bang just by using the laws of physics. And nature itself, understood via experiment, is sufficient for us. It's sufficient to excite us and meet all of our needs. For some people, it isn't sufficient.
Mm-hmm. What's the one thing that you would like people to remember or to know about Richard Feynman?
I think that the thing that I tried to emphasize at the beginning of our discussion, that people know of him as a man full of joie de vivre. His life was fascinating. He loved adventure and excitement, and he loved joking around. But for Feynman, the proof of the pudding was in the science. And he said, reality must take precedence over public relations, for nature cannot be fooled. And that's the greatest lesson I think I'd like to leave with for Feynman, is that it's nature that tells us how it behaves. And if we want to learn how the universe works, we have to get our answers from nature. And we have to be willing to go fearlessly in that direction and do whatever is possible to find out. And Feynman was nothing if not fearless.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you, Lawrence, for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
And tell us a little bit about, you have your ASU Origins project coming up at ASU this year?
Yes, we're having a big event in April, which I hope we'll in fact have some. We'll be back on Science Friday to discuss. We're going to celebrate science and culture, because science is a vital part of our culture, and Origins itself is an area that merges science and culture. The questions of where do we come from, where are we going, and since it spans the two areas, we wanted to have a celebration of culture inspired by science. And so we're bringing together music, and we're having Holtz the Planets with images from NASA and a lecture from Stephen Hawking and actually narration for the music by me. We're bringing Werner Herzog in for his brand new 3D movie on Cave of Forgotten Dreams, which will bring people back to the dawn of modern humanity, and actually a dance number choreographed and produced by Liz Lehrman, a MacArthur Prize winning dance choreographer, on a matter of origins. And so it'll be a whole celebration of science and culture, because one of the things we often forget is that science is not just good for producing technology. It's really addresses our place in the universe and changes our perspective of our place in the universe. And that's what good art, music, literature does. So we should celebrate both.
We will drop in and sample a little from that meeting. Thank you, Lawrence, for taking time to be with us today. Good luck on the book, Quantum Man, Richard Feynman's Life in Science. Have a good weekend.
Thanks again.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Lawrence Krauss is author of Quantum Man, and he is also foundation professor and director of the ASU Origins Project at Arizona State University. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about spacesuits. You won't believe who made them. We'll be right back after this break.
Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When Neil Armstrong stepped out onto the surface of the moon in 1969, he was wearing one of the most technologically advanced outfits ever created. It was the A7L spacesuit. A for Apollo, 7 for the suit generation number, L for latex, as in the International Latex Corporation, or the Playtex Company. You know those folks that make the famous bras? Neil Armstrong wasn't wearing a bra made by latex. He was wearing the spacesuit, which was made by Playtex. Interesting. 25 years later, Armstrong wrote about the spacesuit he wore that day, and he said, "It turned out to be one of the most widely photographed spacecraft in history. There was no doubt that due to the fact that it was so photogenic." Equally responsible for its success was its characteristic of hiding from view its ugly occupant. Its true beauty, however, was that it worked. It was tough, reliable, and almost cuddly. What's interesting about Armstrong's quote is that he's talking about his spacesuit not as an item of protective clothing, but as a spacecraft. And my next guest would agree. He thinks of it as a piece of architecture. Nicholas DiMancio is the author of the book Spacesuit Fashioning Apollo. He's an assistant professor of architecture and urban design at the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
This is a fantastic book, and there's so much in here. And the first thing I want to ask you, though, is what is the cover made out of?
The cover is made out of latex, of course. We had to If you look at the cover, it has that famous picture of Buzz Aldrin on the surface of the moon embossed in white. But then the black background standing in for the inky backdrop of space is the very same material that's hiding underneath all of those white outer layers of the suit, which is black natural latex, the product of a tree.
You know, it's interesting. It's not every day that you hear Neil Armstrong call something cuddly. Right? He's not a sentimental type of guy, but he really felt close to that spacesuit, it seems.
I think Neil Armstrong is actually the very opposite of a sentimental guy. All the astronauts were who I met in the course of researching this book. But what was so compelling to me is that out of all the objects of the entire space race that they feel attached to, they don't, when they come to Washington, they don't visit the giant cathedral of the Air and Space Museum on the Mall. They come out to a tiny warehouse in, I kid you not, Suitland, Maryland, where all the spacesuits are stored. And they want to see them, and they want to make sure they're being taken good care of, and they really regard them as part of themselves.
How did a company that was known for, you know, making bras and girdles and cross your heart and I can't believe it's a bra get into the spacesuit business?
Well, that's a really interesting story. The founder of Playtex, or the International Latex Corporation, to give it its proper name, was a guy named Abram Spinel, who started selling latex products in the 20s, and they would split apart. And so he didn't want to sell latex clothing for adults, where they might be surprised by their clothing coming apart. But he sold diaper covers to babies, which is where the name Playtex came from. And the company was very successful, but almost went under in the Second World War when it had no government contracts. So after the Second World War, Spinel funded an internal research division to just play around with the material, the latex material that the company was working with. And out of those experiments came a proposal to design the Apollo suit in 1962.
Was each one of them handmade?
Each one of them was completely handmade. This is an utterly couture garment, 21 layers of all kinds of different materials, hand-sewn by women who came off the bra and girdle assembly lines to a 64th of an inch tolerance.
Wow.
Particularly astonishing, anyone who's sat in front of a sewing machine will respect not only that tolerance, but also the fact that they couldn't use any pins or fasteners as they sewed these things together, just in case they might puncture the crucial latex bladder and thus threaten the integrity of the air vessel of the suit.
So it was 21 layers.
Yes, and it actually expanded to 29 by the time of Apollo 17.
And did the seamstresses have any say? They're sitting here sewing one stitch at a time, a tolerance of 1/64th of an inch. Did they have any say? And, well, you know, if you try this, you might be a better design.
Oh, absolutely. The most pleasurable, right up there with interviewing guys who'd been on the surface of the moon in terms of the fun I had working on the book, was interviewing these seamstresses who are still all alive and well and in Dover, Delaware, where the company is still based and still making shuttle suits. But they, of course, they had enormous opinions. And the actual process, when you look at how Playtex put these suits together, it was this really kind of fabulous combination of, on the one hand, some engineering expertise, but on the other hand, an enormous amount of informal knowledge, not only from the seamstresses, but from the actual supervisors as well. The main engineer on the Apollo spacesuit project for Playtex, a guy named Lenny Shepard, started out as Spinel, the CEO's television repairman. And Spinel noticed he was so handy and invited him to come work for the company. Another executive, George Durney, started out as a sewing machine salesman who had experience in the Air Force. And so these guys were derided by some at NASA as only having graduated from the School of Hard Knocks. But in the end, they called themselves Hard Knocksers as a kind of badge of honor, because the spacesuit, unlike the rest of the vast systems architecture of Apollo, really was a place where that empirical knowledge was tantamount, and where the kind of sensitive accommodation of the body and all of its flexible needs turned out to be the most important thing.
One of the more interesting, if not most interesting, aspects of your book is that it appeared that when you discovered something on your research, you went with it. There's so many other things in this book about the space race and the evolution of the space program that have nothing to do with the spacesuit, but are so incredibly interesting in
right.
your book How did you – I can imagine you say, I've got to put this in there because no one knew this, you know?
Well, I think it was – if you only saw what I had to take out, I think – but the – no, the – I think one of the reasons, when I first became interested in spacesuits, I thought I was just going to be able to go and read everything that someone had written about this, you know, the most iconic artifact of the 20th century. But nothing was actually written, certainly in design history, about the actual suit that walked on the moon. The only suits that design historians had ever written about were these hard, beautiful prototype suits that were never successful in actually being flown in space, but were much more kind of legible and aesthetically appealing in terms of conventional design thinking. Mm-hmm. And so when I think one of the reasons that the suit had never been written about is because it's such a complicated object. It has these 21 gossamer-thin layers all assembled together to match the body of each astronaut, and then the actual story whereby it's made and all the different people involved is enormously complicated as well. So I had the idea that in the structure of the book, instead of trying to cram all of that into a conventional linear narrative, that I would instead honor the suit by telling 21 interlayered stories that were in some ways a testament to the 21 different interlinked layers of the suit itself.
Talking with Nicolas Dimancho, although I would say Dimancho, if I were in
That's
French.
How the my French ancestors would pronounce it, yes.
Author of the book Spacesuit, Fashioning Apollo, a fascinating book. Let's go to some of the phone calls we have here. Let's go to Jan in Oakhurst, California. Hi, Jan.
Hi there. I love your program. I listen to it all the time and try to inspire my son, who's in science at UC Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
I thought it was very humorous when the gentleman that you're talking with said something about this being Playtex. I had no idea that the space industry was working with Playtex, and that you said they were Playtex girdles.
Well, they're the same company that made the girdles.
Well, what is so funny is, struck me funny, is he said something about them splitting. And I remember being about 14 years of age, very, very self-conscious, as all young girls are, and taking a Greyhound bus from Southern California to Northern California to Humboldt County, and I was wearing my first Playtex girdle. And I got out at a restroom, and when I pulled it down, it split, and I thought, how am I going to get back on this bus with a split girdle that's holding up my stockings? I could hardly breathe. I was so afraid to even move.
Dear.
And it just struck me so funny to think that this is part of the space industry. That's where it began. I had no idea.
Yeah, neither of us did. Thanks for calling, Jen. It's
okay.
A great story. It's lucky the spacesuits didn't do that, right? It's more than luck. It's not luck. It's great planning on their part.
The spacesuits actually had an inner layer of bonded in between the latex was a layer of a fabric called nylon tricot, which is the same thing that bras were made of. So it was really girdle technology and bra technology together that held it all in one piece.
Why didn't Playtex advertise this, or even until no one knew until your book came out?
There's two reasons why. One is that the actual industrial division of Playtex that made spacesuits did split off in the early 1970s and become a company known as ILC Dover, which is still manufacturing shuttle suits today. The second reason is that I think this icon of this masculine heroic narrative is the fact that it's made by Playtex has in some senses. Being a bit embarrassing. It's Playtex. The only reason Playtex made the suit, you can imagine how all these how a kind of masculine culture of engineering accepted an underwear company making spacesuits. They were constantly battling to beat out being edged out and pushed out of the process. But what they had going for them is that they uniquely could actually make a suit that worked. And so there's something about the story that's really interesting, that this heroic icon hides this strange feminine history of handcraft and couture.
Let's talk about some of the designs that did not work, because they fooled around with all kinds of hard shells too, did they not?
Yes, those hard shells were for many years everyone's idea of how man would go into space. And in fact, the RX suits made by Litton Industries were so termed by Joe Cosmo, head of crew systems at NASA, because he called them the prescription, or RX, for spacesuit design. And they're very, very beautiful objects and beautifully engineered, but for all kinds of reasons to do with weight, stowability, and the fact that when they failed catastrophically, recalling the shuttle disaster you were talking about in the previous segment, they never made it to the moon, whereas the kind of flexible, multi-layered architecture of the spacesuit failed softly as well, and therefore was much more similar to, in some ways, to the body that it housed in its characteristics, rather than the giant infrastructure of the space program.
So there was real competition then between...
Oh, there was intense competition. You can imagine this was one of the most closely fought engineering battles of the entire space program. And in fact, the one of the most remarkable stories is when ILC, or Playtex, was indeed successfully edged out of the process at one point in 1965, and then battled its way back into a six-week competition between three companies to produce the final suit that would walk onto the moon. And there was no competition. One suit, when the astronaut was going down the ladder to the lunar lander mock-up, the head of the suit blew off. In the other suit, the shoulders expanded so much while they were walking around on a fake moon surface that the astronaut wouldn't have been able to get back into the lunar capsule. So there was real, in the end, there was actually no competition at all. But it was partly the kind of scrappy origins of this company, not only the fact that it made ladies' underwear, but the fact that it was a small group of people, very few of whom had engineering degrees. They just didn't fit into the larger culture of NASA. But my book argues they did fit very much into the way human bodies actually work.
All right, we're talking with Nicholas DiMoncio, author of Spacesuit, on Science Friday from NPR. And joining us now is Flora Lichtman with a video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
And our video pick has very much to do with this topic, right?
Exactly to do with this topic. It was put together by the producer of this segment, Catherine Wells, and she did an amazing job taking some of these spacesuit tests, footage from NASA, and putting them together into a spacesuit test ballet.
And where did the videos all come from?
Well, we should ask Nicholas, because I think he pulled them up.
Nicholas, these are mostly unseen by the public?
I believe so, yes. They were part of the research I did. I was very fortunate to be a fellow for a year at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, which is the only job I've had in my life that my 8-year-old self was thoroughly on board with. And while I was there, I was able to go through all kinds of astonishing archives, both at the Air and Space Museum and at the National Archives. And those videos are part of the materials that I pulled together in just trying to figure out this puzzle of how the suit was made and how it worked and how these other alternatives were considered at the time.
And our video show is very interesting. Catherine made a terrific video. She took these videos you discovered, NASA's testing out these spacesuits.
And they're so zany. I mean, it's so fun to watch because you can see some of the flops. And I really wanted to ask you about that bubble suit, which you have to go to the website to look at because it really is pretty weird. What was that big see-through bubble all about?
Well, I think a lot of those suits, especially some of the crazier experiments, were about the fact that, especially in the early 1960s, the NASA engineers, the engineers who had been working successfully on ICBMs and all these other tremendously complicated technological systems, tried to approach designing for the human body in the same way as they'd designed a gyroscope or a fire control system for a missile, and therefore thinking from first principles, what's more flexible and mobile than a ball, produce these kinds of bizarre, fascinating results. This is certainly what interests me as an architect and someone who designs for people every day. Is too often, even today, we kind of try and fit the way that bodies and cities and all the other messy things that human societies are made of into these elegant diagrams, and the results are comical when they're at the level of a spacesuit, but when they're at the level of an urban redevelopment plan, sometimes not so much.
All right, Nicholas, we've run out of time, but I want to invite you back. Maybe when the we have in July when the anniversary of the walk on the moon comes up, because there's so much in this book about the space race and about the media and how the pictures came back from the moon in a very unusual and unusable way, why they're so grainy, how the White House was cooperating with the media in the whole space race. Would you come back in July and talk more about what was going on?
I'd be delighted to.
Just fascinating stuff. And thank you for taking time to be with us. Nicholas DeMancha, who is author of Spacesuit, Fashioning Apollo. Have a good weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Our video pick of the week is up there. And it's a really wonderful video by Catherine Wells. It's really a spacesuit ballet with music and all kinds of wacky spacesuits. That's about all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and with help from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. We're also, for our April 1st show is coming up, we want you to write us, send us a science joke. You know, you hear your physicist, a biologist. What are some of the jokes you tell each other? Maybe two scientists walked into a bar and blah, 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 or something else. Go to our website, our Facebook site, Facebook.com/SciFry. Leave your joke there. We'll collect all of them. And also, you can go to our website, Science Friday, and hit on our little button that'll tell you how to phone in your joke. If you'd like to call in your joke and tell it yourself, we're very happy to have you do that. We'll collect the jokes for our April 1st, you know what day that is, show, and maybe we'll be able to get as many of those jokes in as we can. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. I'm Ira Flatow, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and make a donation. Thanks again.